Hello, this is Ken McLeod. Thousands of people around the world listen to these podcasts every week, just as you are doing now. If you find them helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Your generosity helps us maintain and expand the website for the benefit of yourself and other practitioners worldwide. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, Pointing Out Instructions, Part 7.
In all honesty, I'm not quite sure what to talk about this evening.
Okay.
Chances are I'll find something. My main concern in this retreat is, I think some of you have come to suspect, is to show you to the best I can a way into experience, not learning more things about Mahamudra. Coming to know it experientially. This is not an altogether easy matter. Trungpa used to speak of the Zap approach, which is one of the more common methods of teaching. Teachers go around and they zap everybody with energy or what have you. People have these experiences. He also said that someone needs to be there to change the diapers. So, far more, my personal feeling is that while experience is important, I'm thinking of the Zap approach here. Developing the capability within oneself is actually more important. There are a large number of teachers and students who take the approach that the right experience will save you. This attitude or perspective would significantly enhanced or reinforced by Philip Kaplow's Three Pillars of Zen. How many of you are familiar with that? In which it's basically all about Satori. An anecdote is told of Suzuki Roshi, the author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, founder of Zen Center in San Francisco. It's found in the introduction to the second edition of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, where Houston Smith is talking with Suzuki Roshi, and he says, your book has become a classic, but you never mention the word Satori. And Suzuki's wife says, that's because he hasn't had it. I remember Bob Aiken saying to Maizumi Roshi, I never got past Mu. And Maizumi Roshi said, oh, thank goodness I didn't either. But you look at the way some people write, some people teach, and it's all about having the right experience. Now, certain experiences change our understanding of the world and of ourselves and experience. But what happens afterwards is very important. Research into near-death experiences, where people have often quite profound and very powerful experiences of one sort or another, showed that those experiences had no significant or measurable effect in their lives three months later, except for one class of people. Any guesses? No. No, there's only one. Pardon?
The people that took up the message of the experience?
No, that's what they were trying to see, how many people took up the message of the experience. Only one class.
What were the different classes?
Well, they only found one thing that, one factor in people's backgrounds, which was significant here. Any guesses? It's rather disturbing. Experience of childhood trauma.
Childhood trauma.
The article I read didn't say.
So you're saying that the experience that then you passed that in some way?
Yeah, something happened.
Yeah.
And they took the message and started to live. Which is interesting.
It is interesting.
Now, Sun Sen wrote an article about what kind of effort lay people should make. And he starts off the article saying very firmly, almost categorically, if you're a layperson, forget about getting enlightened. Leave that to the professionals. The full-time monks and nuns. That's their job. Is to get enlightened. That's why they became monks and nuns. You're lay people. It's not your job. You got too many other things to think about. You got a career, you got a job, you got responsibilities, you got family, you got this, you got that. You know, leave that heavy duty stuff to the professionals. Your job as lay people is to function properly so that as a parent, you're a good parent. In your job, you do a good job. In your relationships, you're there. So everything should be directed at learning how to function properly. And then at the end of the article, it slips in the sentence. Of course, it's good to remember that the purpose of getting enlightened is to learn is so you can function properly. Miyamoto Musashi is probably the greatest of the Japanese swordsmen. Must have been quite a person. Apparently he wanted to understand sex so badly that he slept with 1,000 women, much to the chagrin of his wife, who finally had enough and said, "Stop it." So he did. I think that's the same person.
Did he understand?
There's a mystery to him. He had 60 duels, which is an extraordinary number. These are life and death affairs. He stopped killing his opponents after the 30th. And he dueled the man, not the weapon. So the way he won was often very interesting. Well, we're reading some of the accounts. But by the time he was 30 or so, he found that he didn't need to kill his opponents anymore. They couldn't kill him. He often fought duels with a wooden sword. The other opponent's sword would get stuck and it struck the wood. Later in his life, he studied Zen with and Hakuin was one of these, it seems, as one of his teachers. And there's one book that he wrote, it's The Five Rings, which he wrote by climbing an extremely long flight of steps. And you can find pictures of this. Stone steps up to a chapel where he would meditate with a paper and ink beside him. And he would sit there and meditate. And when he knew what this next sentence was, he'd write it down. Then we go back to his meditation. This is how he wrote The Five Rings. It took several months. There weren't any revisions. Just, that was the next sentence. So quotation from his work, which about martial arts, which I haven't written down and I haven't memorized, so I will repeat it as best I can. But it's I've adopted this quotation and just substituted the word Buddhism for martial arts. And it's to the effect that when you engage this practice, or the view that many people have of this practice, is that it's not really practical, but that the real purpose of this practice is to develop skill so that in every situation that you meet, you can meet it and employ that skill in that situation. That's very rough. It says it much better than that. So tonight, I'm going to talk a little more generally than we have. have up to this point. Much of Buddhism focuses on meditation. And it's very easy when you study and practice Buddhism to get the feeling that you are only truly alive when you're meditating. Everything else is kind of a waste of time. Anybody come across this notion? And the only real form of life is retreat. This, of course, is nonsense. And there are many reasons why, how that, for that attitude and that perspective having developed, but we don't need to go into those. One of the consequences of this is that how you actually live is, for many people who practice Buddhism, a bit of a puzzle. How you actually live is, for many people who practice Buddhism, a bit of a puzzle. Because you have these very high perspectives, non-duality, the great completion, even the middle way, interdependent origination, six perfections, four immeasurables. Any of you heard of any of these? Oh yes, of course, the old favorite, the Noble Eightfold Path. But how you actually live any of these, not talked about all that much. At least that's been my experience. Would anybody else in the same boat here? No, I mean, this has been explained to you good, you can come up here and ask. I'll give you an example. I had a student many years ago who was a private banker. Private banker is a person who works for one of the major banks, like Bank of America or something like that. And this person's job is to cater to the people who bank with the Bank of America who have more than $1 million in deposit. They get their own private banker. Well, she drove a Mercedes. And she remembers being at a practice group discussion in which the topic of discussion that evening was, if you're practicing Noble Eightfold Path, what kind of car should you drive? She was very, very glad that she'd parked her Mercedes several blocks away. And I give you this as an example of the kind of confusion that is present in a lot of people's minds. And the confusion arises from many, many different factors. To name just a few, there is the importation of what is essentially a monastic discipline from a medieval agricultural or agriculturally based society into the postmodern technological multicultural society, where Buddhism, it's all actually up until the 20th century, is pretty well practiced only in monocultural societies. So there are a few little adjustments in there. But in addition, we also import in ways that are not at all obvious. A lot of Christian ideas that have come to permeate Western thinking. One of them, and I mention this because I've been reading about this recently, and I found it very interesting, and I say this is not at all obvious, is the one of the biggest influences of Christianity in Western thinking is that history has meaning. You know, and that's something that was a line of thought that developed out of Christian influence on Western thought and was unknown before that. And so, and it's become one of the central characteristics of modernism, is that history has meaning, and thus we have to make progress. So the whole notion of progress comes from here as well. One should take note that it was an obsession with progress that was behind Nazism and communism and all of the totalitarian regimes, and is also what is actually behind radical Islamic fundamentalism. That you can create a perfect society by force. So, in my own practice, partially because I think I'm so bad at it, what Musashi talks about, what Sun Sen talks about, becoming skilled in life, makes a great deal of sense to me. And I spoke about this, I think, right at the beginning of this retreat. To truly meet what the situations that arise in our life appropriately or effectively or skillfully, however you want to put it, if you want to put it in the Buddhist terminology, in a way that does not create suffering, or if you want to put it in Mahayana terminology, to meet what arises in the union of compassion and emptiness, or express that. There's one small prerequisite. You have to be able to be nobody so you can be anybody. Martial arts. Traditionally, there are three steps in training. The first is to learn the technique. You learn the various moves, how to make them, train the body so that it can make those moves. That's not so bad. The second is to train so that those moves are second nature. They just have. I studied some martial arts for a short period of time with a couple. They're very, very good. They're very good people. And they were extremely good martial artists. And they're also quite good teachers. They slept with a board between them. Because if one flopped an arm over on the other, it wasn't clear what was going to happen. This was the price they paid for their training. That's not actually unusual. I have another friend who's trained in martial arts. He advises his girlfriends, never approach me from behind. Just don't do that. Because he's trained. This is what training means. We apply this in our practice so that when somebody says something, you don't have to think about responding with compassion. It just happens. If you have to think about it, you're already too late. You're not going to wipe them out or kill them, but it needs to have the same level of training. Third step in martial arts is to remove everything in you that would prevent that from manifesting when it needs to.
Say that again.
You remove everything inside which would prevent the technique from manifesting when it was needed. That gets fairly serious. This is about becoming normal. In the context of our training, it's the same thing. You remove everything, all of those habituations, all of those idealizations, all of those values, all of that stuff, which prevents you from responding to the struggles of others. This is somewhat non-trivial. This is what is actually involved in the training. It's often not talked about in these terms. People think, oh, it's so wonderful to be compassionate. This is complete nonsense. Many years ago, I was doing a retreat in Washington. This is early 90s, I guess. It was on the four immeasurables, compassion in particular. It was very interesting. There was a huge gender difference in the response to the cultivation of compassion. For the men, it was, by and large, I've never felt anything like this. I didn't know this world existed. What are all the women thinking now?
We already know that.
For the woman, the response was a little different. Now how do I say no? Yeah. Something I took note of and I've always tuned my teaching of compassion to. It's very, very different experiences, particularly in this culture. What is compassion like? Anybody? What is it actually like, Ken?
I don't know myself, but Kerberos used to define it as environmental generosity. that didn't require feedback to a reference point.
Yes, that may be a definition. But I'm asked, what is compassion like? What is it like to experience compassion? Alan, then Ralph. Alan first.
I've heard the podcast, maybe talk to you.
Oh, you're going to crib for me. That doesn't count. I'm not your own. Ralph, are you cribbing for the podcast too?
Probably. I think it's putting yourself aside so you can be with someone.
Yeah.
So that they can.
That's a description. What is it like?
Well, it's like your chest really feels a lot of openness, and sometimes there's some discomfort. Well, the chest feels a lot of openness, and sometimes it's a little bit painful, but it can also be pretty relieving to feel it. Feel you're not all caught up in yourself anymore. I'm a physician, and I can be having a rough time myself and go to work and feel better when someone tells me their rotten story because it opens my heart.
Okay. Alan?
It's like having no skin.
Yeah. It's not a little bit painful. Mm-hmm. It's like having no skin. Now, imagine having no skin and somebody touches you. What does that feel like?
I would think it would be excruciating.
Yes. But as Leslie pointed out, there is another quality to it. In that compassion, you know you are touching what is true. But whoever thinks it's a wonderful state, some misguided poet somewhere. Now, how many of you want to live like that? I will hold you to it. I've got your names. As you will see in the interviews tomorrow.
Could I have a question?
Yes. Please.
If there's a true realization of emptiness, would that pain become suffering, or would it just be pain?
If there is a true realization of emptiness, would the pain become suffering?
Yeah. For the person bestowing the compassion. Or...
Why would it become suffering?
Well, if there's no...
If there is a realization of emptiness, or if there is no realization of emptiness?
No. If there is a realization of emptiness, would that pain then not become suffering for the person that is the...
Oh, then it wouldn't be suffering, you're saying?
Yeah.
One taste, right?
Yeah.
You shouldn't believe all the fairy tales. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that if you take that approach, you form an idea of how things will be. That really mucks up your practice now. Mm-hmm. You have an idea, oh, it will be like this. It's irrelevant whether it is or isn't. We have to deal with how things are now.
Yeah. When I think about this issue with compassion, I remember one time my girlfriend's daughter and I were roughhousing, playing around, and I ended up with a strange swollen blood vessel in my scrotum. And it was painful. I had to go to the doctor, and he squeezed it, and it was so painful I passed out. And the next thing I remember, I opened my eyes and I was looking up at him, and he was bent over me with absolutely no expression of fear or anxiety in his face. And when I saw that, I just completely relaxed. And, recovered very easily. But I reflect back on that, and I attribute that to his skill.
Mm-hmm.
That he didn't get bent out of shape by the fact that all of a sudden I passed out and landed on his floor. And that was so reassuring to me. And that if I were in the process of helping somebody, that I actually did this quite a bit, I should say, in my work as a social worker, in a real place that people wanted to die. And when I first worked there, I used to get very anxiety-ridden when somebody was talking about their death, and they would obviously be very, very anxiety-ridden. And I started sort of peddling these platitudes and realized how phony and superficial the whole thing was. And it took me a few months to relax with the whole thing, and it completely changed my relationship with these people who were dying. Okay, so I'm saying this to suggest that, okay, if somebody is in agony because they're helping you, I wouldn't be consoled by that. I would, as the receiver of the help, it would make me feel.
Yes, I quite understand your point. Yes. Not quite what I was saying. With these people who are dying.
Yeah.
Did you feel the pain?
I felt...
Were you able to stay present in the pain of the situation?
Not at first.
Not at first, exactly.
Right.
But you developed that ability.
Yes.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was your ability to stay present in the pain of the situation.
Right.
That enabled you to be helpful to them.
Yeah, that, and also, I think the honesty that I was able to establish with them.
Right.
So that I wasn't bullshitting them into.
Yeah, you weren't trying to be anybody.
And I wasn't dealing with my own anxiety because I was relaxed. I wasn't trying to cover up my own anxiety by these platitudes.
Yeah. This is exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And compassion is being able to be present in the pain.
Right.
And letting go of all of the ideas about what we should be doing.
Oh,
we should be doing. Okay. Now, this is the motivation for this practice.
Mm-hmm.
Is to develop the ability to be no one in any situation. So you can respond, in the phrase that Uchiyama uses, to the direction of the present. Question.
Well, I just want to say something about what I've noticed with men and women in my practice. That when I tell a couple bad news, it's always the woman who cries, and it's always the man who puts his arm around her. And that doesn't mean a man doesn't feel it. It's just he's structured to stay together until later. I just think that's the way men are made.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I was reading a book that I got at the airport on the way here called The Female Brain, and there's a huge difference between men and women physiologically.
Yes, male brain is the. Screwed up one.
Oh no, I mean, someone has to stay together.
Yeah, no, it's the male brain develops from the female brain.
Yes. Yeah. But the man still somewhere feels it. He just is made to be able to stay more distant from
it. But a lot of men just learn the staying distant part.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, just sort of on the same note, when I was like, I mentioned I had spent some time at Genpo Abbot, which is, you know, a monastic community. And it's men and women, and what happens, the way they set up a shrine room is they have the men on the left and the women on the right, you're facing the shrine. That's how they, you go in and kind of, everybody sits in these two, like, rectangles.
Men on the left, women on the right?
Yeah.
Interesting, okay.
That was, yeah, that was how it went. Yeah. So, my knees were never that good. You know, it's like 3 or 4 hours of sitting a day. I used a lot of times to be in the back in a chair, but I noticed always, this was really weird, well, not that weird, based on what we're saying, but if you looked at the men's side of the room, you know, the men would be like slumped over, asleep, or like this, or scratching themselves, or like, you know, whatever, or looking out the window, and women were all, it was always like 2 or 3 that were crying. And I was always really admiring of that, because I felt like, I mean, I don't know if I was right, but I always felt like at least they were dealing with something directly, whereas, like, I spent all the time I was there trying to get to certain meditation states. You know? Like, at least they were in touch with something real, not just, like, you know, kind of in a certain pose.
That's reflecting what Leslie was saying. Okay. So, I'm not saying that when you're exercising compassion that you're writhing in agony. But you're feeling something quite intensely. And many people put up barriers to that, both men and women. Those barriers are put up because there's the notion that there is something to protect. So, all of you have been investigating mind over the last few days. Several of you have told me, through your own experience, that there's nothing there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I have a question. What is there to protect? Well, we have to bear in mind Yogi Berra's saying, in theory, there's no difference between practice and theory. In practice, there is. Mahamudra prayer. Page 26. While the nature of being beings has always been full enlightenment, not knowing this, they wander in endless samsara. For the boundless suffering of sentient beings, may overwhelming compassion be born in my being. So, when you know how to do something, and you see someone struggling with the same thing, but they don't know how to do it, what do you feel?
You want to help them do it.
You want to help them do it. it's really difficult to watch them struggle, isn't it? You just want to get in there and say, did it. What's the discomfort?
Seeing them suffering.
Pardon?
Well, seeing them in difficulty.
Yeah, well, what's the discomfort in you?
It's a defense.
Against?
I would say it's a defense against empathy or compassion. Because quite often when you help someone who is struggling, you do them a disservice. It's very situational.
I agree. Anybody else?
I guess what you're saying is you don't want to experience feeling their difficulty.
Yeah. You don't want to... Well, their number, what is it? You might think, I'm better than you, I can do this faster.
Yeah.
Or you can...
Or it could just be the discomfort of watching somebody...
Yeah, it's uncomfortable.
Randy?
I think you don't want to get involved. You don't want to put a piece of yourself out there.
Actually, most people do want to put a piece of themselves
no,
out there, so they don't have
they
to
do,
face
but there's that. But there's that struggle.
Okay. Nancy?
I think it's that if you fix it for them, then you don't have to open your heart, because it's fixed.
Peter?
Let's see. I think people I don't like who do that is to fix it for you and not show you how to fix it or not take the time to be with you. He'll take you each step of the way and help guide you. At least in my teaching, that's what I find really helps students the most. It empowers them to learn on their own. So when you can be patient on people.
Say what you said again, Nancy.
That if you fix it for them, whatever they're struggling with, then it's resolved, and you don't have to open yourself to compassion, which would be you would have to if you're just watching them struggle with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The only way to stay present in this situation is to feel the pain in the situation.
Or leave.
Or, no, then you're not staying in the situation. And sometimes, you know, you get, this is too painful, I've got to get out of here. Okay. This is what is being referred to in these lines. While the nature of beings has always been full enlightenment, not knowing this, they wander in endless samsara for the boundless suffering of sentient beings. Here, coming to the end of this prayer, you understand, or you know Muhammad directly, you know you're not a thing, and you see all these sentient beings floundering around in their lives, believing that they're things, making a mess of everything, trying to get what they want, never succeeding. And you just go, oh, right?
Mm-hmm. Don't you think a lot of people's struggle and anxiety is because they're afraid they're nobody? Or they're afraid, you know, a lot of people search for, who am I?
There's all kinds of things, but we're not talking about them, we're talking about watching these, you know. And... the people who think that they're nobody have a very well-defined identity. It's formed around the belief that they're nobody. They don't count. So there's a very well-defined sense of self there. Mm-hmm. I'm a self that doesn't count in this world.
But there are a lot of people who develop a whole personality out of the kind of like a oyster covering a pearl.
That's what the personality is. Layers and layers and layers of protective mechanisms defending against these deeply held beliefs, which are usually associated with experiences that weren't able to be experienced. Nancy?
Well, I would say that kind of person is the most difficult for me to feel compassion for.
Which kind of person?
What you just described. You know, the person... that is struggling really in the world, but makes the same struggle all the time, just putting one more layer on top of the other, and always feeling that no one is paying attention or being compassionate. And it's very difficult, I think. For me, it's very difficult.
Okay. Well, either where your work is. Okay. So, the compassion that arises here is an emotion. As such, it's subject to corruption and decay. That's all emotions are. The next verse. While such compassion is active and immediate, in the moment of compassion, its essential emptiness is nakedly clear. Even though the way this is written in Tibetan, and the word, same word is used, they're really talking about two completely different things. Compassion is the natural expression of awareness. Compassion at this level is non-referential. It doesn't depend on a framework. It is how awareness manifests. It is, to be precise, the expression of the clarity aspect of mind. And it is not an emotion. It's not subject to corruption or decay. It's a very different beast. In that union of emptiness and compassion. In the moment of compassion, its essential emptiness is nakedly clear.
What is the "its" referred to there? Its essential emptiness.
The compassion. In the moment of compassion, compassion's essential emptiness is nakedly clear. This is the union of compassion and emptiness. But in this is not an emotion joining with emptiness. This is mind itself, which is simultaneously empty and clear. And that's how it manifests in experience. The reason this is important, or one of the reasons, is that you don't have to do anything at this point. It just arises. In referring to the remarks I made earlier, that compassion, that level of compassion, non-referential compassion, arises because you've eliminated everything that gets in the way. Third step in training. You become empty. And the way emptiness expresses itself is as compassion. Now there are a couple of questions from it. Larry?
There's the discrimination between the compassion that is that raw quality and the compassion that functions as the clarity of awareness.
Yeah, I would say that the even at the level of compassion and awareness, there's still a very raw quality because you're directly in touch with the pain of the world. So I don't see that as going away in that sense. But that it's not an emotional reaction to it. Though most people will experience it as a very powerful emotion. That is, people who are on the receiving end will experience it as a very powerful emotion. It becomes completely natural. Another thing, I think I said this earlier in this retreat, but I'll repeat it here because it's appropriate. The illusion of choice is an indication of the lack of freedom.
You did say that.
Yes. Is it making any more sense now? Tom.
And we're using the word compassion in a certain context here, this Buddhist, context. What about the word love? How do they relate? Or do they?
Well, that's a very interesting question. In Buddhism, as you well know, we have loving kindness and compassion, four immeasurables. And the way that love is used in other religious traditions, it often partakes of something with the qualities of compassion. I think it's more a difference in emphasis. And I would put it, perhaps erroneously, in these terms. That love, the emphasis is on the quality of opening and receiving. And in compassion, the emphasis is on being present with what is. Now, I'd say there's a fair degree of overlap there, but if I were to make a distinction, I'd say that the emphasis was something like that. That makes sense to you.
Well, can't you turn the tables a little bit here? Don't mind. But what you're describing, really, talking about compassion, it sounds so abstract, so distant from my experience, really.
Okay.
Fantastic. Really, it's not fantastic. It's even more fantastic than what Ken Beal was talking about after realization. I mean, this state of mind is way higher than the realization of emptying state of mind. So, aren't you saying that are we setting up an ideal expecting this kind of experience? This is not our experience of compassion. It's nothing to do with what we're experiencing when we're talking about compassion. So, are we kind of way up there, somewhere, far away?
Far away is your mind, Vladimir. How far away is it?
From my mind?
How far away is your mind? How far is it from you?
I'm not.
Okay. Pardon?
Not a hair tip.
Not a hair tip, okay. I understand where your question's coming from. The reason I'm talking about this at all is that you can go there in any moment. And it is like jumping or stepping off into that bottomless abyss in the same way that we talked about emptiness the other night. Most people, I find, have actually experienced this. Ken and Leslie have described situations where they encounter it in their work. But, and the circumstances in which I find most frequent is when person A has a friend or a close relative or someone who's close to them come and tell them about something that's tragic or devastating in their life. And what happens? Not infrequently is that person A ceases to be a person at that point. And they find themselves present with their friend. They don't know where the words are coming from. They don't have any experience of being a part or a distinct entity. And looking back on it, it feels magical. That is the unity of emptiness and compassion. So I don't think it is remote, as you were expressing a few moments ago. When people look back on such occasions, they often can't really take in that they were capable of it. You know, and they discount it, or discount themselves in that way, if you see what I mean. With the training that we're undertaking here, creating the conditions and the know-how, actually, which makes it possible for you to do this whenever you wish. So, somebody comes and tells you they have a problem. What happens if you drop into the empty mind and you have some experience with? You just go there. What happens?
Well, I would respond without concern for all the blockages that would be put up by myself, concerning myself.
Yeah. That's the connection. Randy, you had a question. Because your hand was up before Vladimir. I also read minds. You have a neon sign above you flashing. Question, question, question. Tirugongpa, it's a 12th century teacher in the Shangpa tradition. Had a kind of interesting life. You see, the Tukul system originally developed to keep real estate in the family. But when you have a celibate order, keeping real estate in the family is a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
How do you do it? Well, if you're the abbot of a monastery, your brother has a son. He takes over the abbot. His brother has a son. So it goes from uncle to nephew. Follow? This is how the transmission takes place in the Sakya tradition to this day. This is the origin of the tuple system. Because the nephew was regarded as the incarnation of the abbot when he took over. He has continued the mind stream. This is how you keep real estate in the family in celibate order. So Chair Gongpa was one such nephew. And it was his responsibility to take over the administration of the local monastery. There was a problem. He wanted to practice. He didn't want to run the monastery at all. He told this to the monks, and they wouldn't hear of it. Don't forget, these were basically tribal structures, and so this is like the head of the tribe saying, "No, I don't want to do it." You don't have that kind of choice. Well, Chergonf was pretty insistent about this, and so he just walked out, went to a cave some distance from the monastery, and practiced. The monks were very angry. They stationed people outside. They took shifts. And whenever Chair Gongpa tried to leave his cave in order to go begging for alms, they threw stones at him. So he had to stay there for a long time without any food. So he's kind of an interesting guy.
Did the monasteries own most of the land in Tibet?
No. It was split. So, in a small snippet of his writings that Contra included in one of the texts I studied in retreat, Chair Gongpa says, there are three doors. Impermanence, compassion, and devotion. Impermanence is a door for many people. That's why it has always been a very important practice in Buddhism. Compassion we've already talked about. And devotion also. Devotion is another way of opening one's heart, opening one's mind. And it's why it is actually the central practice in Vajrayana. Vajrayana is, in essence, a devotional tradition, a devotional form of practice, because your way into all of the other practices is through devotion. Kagyu tradition is, as a specialty, devotion. So. We find the same thing in Japan. At the Zen school, which is basically an insight school, you have the Pure Land school, which is basically a devotional school. Thousands more people have been liberated through the Pure Land school, which is Zen. Zen just has better press. So, one of the principal methods of coming to experience Mahamudra is through the practice of devotion. That's what Guru Yoga is about. You pray, What time is it? Good grief. You see how devotion pierces my heart. As the title of that prayer. And another prayer the commentator wrote on the mind training manual was soothing the pain of faith. This tells you how you pray. And the line that I read the other night from the fire offering or the burnt offering: uprooting patterned existence from its depths, I pray. I've talked about feeling compassion and the intensity with which true compassion is experienced. Same applies to devotion. You know, you let your heart open that much, and it feels like it's being torn out of your chest when you pray. Or if you feel that, then you're probably in fairly good shape in terms of your practice. Not many people actually want to practice that way. They like things to be a little more comfortable. But that's Good Tsongpa is one of the Drupa Kagyu patriarchs. Went to an island and he practiced Guru Yoga for 30 days. Like this. At the end of that time, he had stable attention around the clock. So, yeah. It's a path. Dana.
You mentioned three doors. The first was impermanence.
Compassion and devotion.
Okay, well, and you kind of correlated in certain schools. What is the impermanence? Is that part of, how does that fit?
I don't know of any tradition that
the impermanent schools don't stay around.
That was great. It's an interesting question. I don't know of any school that has taken impermanence as their path, their door. Mm-hmm. But many individuals, this has been their door. But I don't think any one tradition has. So.
Okay.
We're the death school. I remember one of my first small groups starting in the late 80s, what eventually became the curriculum in Wake Up to Your Life. But there was just a very small group of people, five or six. John was part of that. But there was a fairly well-known psychiatrist who called me up and said, I'd like to study this with you, Ken. I said, what are you going to do? And I described this as on death and impermanence. And his response was, This is very interesting. Please signify your interest in joining this group by banging your head with this hammer. But it was very fruitful. So it's not a pocket or something. But it is. Okay. Some of you probably will have heard this in listening to podcasts. But we'll conclude here. I should have the page numbers memorized by now, but I don't. There we are. Okay, this is it. Once upon a time, there was a merchant named Abdul Malik. He was known as the good man of Khorasan, because from his immense fortune he used to give to charity and hold feasts for the poor. But one day it occurred to him that he was simply giving away some of what he had, and that the pleasure which he obtained through his generosity was far in excess of what it really cost him to sacrifice what was, after all, such a small portion of his wealth. As soon as this thought entered his mind, he decided to give away every penny for the good of mankind. And he did so. No sooner had he divested himself of all his possessions, resigned to face whatever events life might have in store for him, Abdul Malik saw, during his meditation hour, a strange figure seemed to rise from the floor of his room. A man was taking shape before his very eyes, dressed in the patchwork robe of the mysterious dervish. "Oh, Abdul Malik, generous man of Khorasan," intoned the apparition. "I am your real self, which has now become almost real to you, because you have done something really charitable, measured against which your previous record of goodness is as nothing. Because of this, and because you are able to part with your fortune without feeling personal satisfaction, I am rewarding you from the real source of reward. In future, I will appear before you in this way every day. You will strike me, and I will turn into gold. You will be able to take from this golden image as much as you may wish. Do not fear that you will harm me, because whatever you take will be replaced from the source of all endowments." So saying, he disappeared. The very next morning, a friend named Bayakal was sitting with Abdul Malik when the dervish specter began to manifest itself. Abdul Malik struck it with a stick and the figure fell to the ground, transformed into gold. He took part of it for himself and gave some of the gold to his guest. Now, Bayakal, not knowing what had gone before, started to think how he could perform a similar wonder. He knew that dervishes had strange powers and concluded that it was necessary only to beat them to obtain gold. So he arranged for a feast to be held, to which every dervish who heard of it could come and eat his fill. When they had all eaten well, Bayakal took up an iron bar and thrashed every dervish within reach until they lay battered and broken on the ground. Those dervishes who were unharmed seized Bayakal and took him to the judge. They stated their case and produced the wounded dervishes as evidence. Beyakal related what had happened at Abdul Malik's house and explained his reasons for trying to reproduce the trick. Abdul Malik was called, and on the way to the court, his golden self whispered to him what to say. "May it please the court," he said. "This man seems to be insane, or to be trying to cover up some penchant for assaulting people without cause. I do know him, but his story does not correspond with my own experiences in my house." Beyakal was therefore placed for a time in a lunatic asylum until he became more calm. The dervishes recovered almost at once through some science known to themselves. And nobody believed that such an astonishing thing as a man who becomes a golden statue, and daily at that, could ever take place. For many another year, until he was gathered to his forefathers, Abdul Malik continued to break the image which was himself, and to distribute its treasure, which was himself, to those whom he could not help in any other way than materially. Okay. Take a break here.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.